Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we focus on changing politics in our country through the lens of Christian conservatives. Later in the hour, political scientist Kedron Bardwell of Simpson College will be with us. In the first half hour, a conversation I had yesterday with Bob Vanderplaats. He's CEO of The Family Leader. The Iowa-based organization describes its mission as inspiring Christ-like leadership in the church, home, and government. I began by asking Bob Vanderplaats if he was surprised by Roy Moore's loss in Alabama.
Yeah, I'm not so sure if I'd call it surprise. What we saw with Judge Roy Moore being the candidate for the Republicans is a lot of very serious allegations launched against him. And now he denies it, but there's still a court of public opinion, which some may say is unfair, but I've learned in politics, everything's fair. And so therefore, the people of Alabama, they had a judge, Judge Roy Moore. And I think, they put in their verdict and they elected Doug Jones, which, for a Democrat to win in a deep red state like Alabama, something had to have happened. But I don't think we should read too much into it about a wave election for the Democrats or this or that. I think what it is you had a candidate with serious allegations against him, and the people of Alabama spoke.
Mm-hmm. What are you reading into this as far as any possible wider significance outside the borders of Alabama?
Well, I'm hoping, I really do hope, with the outcome of Alabama, that Americans are looking at themselves in the mirror and say, we want a higher standard for people who represent us, for people who lead us. We want men and women of the highest of integrity. Matter of fact, the scripture, which we're very concerned about here at the Family Leader, says, your elected officials are ministers of God. That's Romans 13. And so you want to have the highest of standards for your elected officials. And so if that is what's coming out of Alabama, that we want high standards, and if there's credible allegations that tell us otherwise, you're not going to be elected, then I think that's a good thing for this country. We would like to see people of the highest integrity leading us.
Mm-hmm. We have had plenty of Christian conservatives backing Roy Moore and did in this election. It seems, there's the focus on the issues and the moral character. How do you decide, or how do you decide for yourself, and how do you recommend Christian conservatives look at moral character versus issues? Can you support a person who has less than great moral character if that person is on your issues in the right way?
Well, I think it's a little bit of a yes and let me try to explain that. So what we say here, the Family Leader, is don't ever let your testimony be disqualified. Don't ever let your testimony be compromised. So therefore, if you're going to go in, and we were not in the race in Alabama, but if you were going to go into Alabama, and for whatever reason you said you were going to support Roy Moore, you better be first open and willing to say, listen, he's a very flawed candidate. We have some very serious concerns and misgivings. And if he is found to be guilty, under an ethics investigation or anything else, we believe he should be removed immediately. But the only reason I'm supporting him is because of the issues that we believe are according to God's heart. Now, to say that you're just going to endorse Roy Moore and you're going to dismiss all the allegations and their stuff, that would be disingenuous and you're going to compromise your testimony. So I think, yes, you want to have people of high character, understanding that we all fall short. And then you also want to take a look at, okay, what are the issues that are going to be advanced under a Doug Jones or under a Roy Moore? And so it gets to be, if you're a Facebook status, it's complicated.
Mm-hmm. How would you have voted in Alabama?
That's a really good question. And I never really put it to myself because I was not going to vote in Alabama. And Roy Moore, I've known Roy Moore for a long time. And the thing that was always the disconnect for me, Ben, is that the people of Alabama, they elected Roy Moore several times to public office. And And so to me, the disconnect, if this was his first run for public office, I think it'd be an easy decision. But they elected him several times to public office. And think that if this was an issue, should this not have been brought up? So I really don't know how at the end of the day I would have voted for Roy Moore. There is no doubt that the allegations concern me gravely. And yet the positions that I believe Doug Jones is going to advance in his leadership, those would be things that, you know, are disconnected from me as well. I believe life begins at conception, that each and every day of a person's life is ordained before one of them comes to be. And we should allow that child to have life. And if I understand Doug Jones' position correctly, he's for basically unlimited abortion. Mm-hmm. And that to me is it's a hard thing to bear, because I think it's the greatest travesty of our day, is that we are a nation that is willing to abort our children.
Back to the question, though, there. I mean, basically four choices, and I'm asking you this because you are a political activist, and I would think you would have an answer. So your choices would have been Roy Moore, Jones, a write-in candidate, or not vote at all. Where would you have landed?
You know, the question I think becomes is that if, first of all, I'm not in Alabama, so therefore I don't have to make that decision. But two is, and matter of fact, this is my counsel, is that the people of Alabama should speak. They're the ones who know him best. They're the ones who know if they trust. Obviously, the people of Alabama threw up the other night a huge caution flag for Roy Moore. I don't know if they said, you know, he's guilty, but it was enough of a caution flag that you had a Republican state, a deep red state, vote for a Democrat candidate.
What do you think this means for the Republican Party? Of course, picking through the wreckage after this Alabama special Senate election, what are your concerns about the conservative agenda of the Republicans?
Well, I think for, you know, the Republican Party, I think it's just a deal of, and again, I don't know if I'd weigh a lot into about this is the message it would send. I think if Republicans, hey, you have the presidency, you have the Congress, you have the Senate, deliver results for the country. And if you can deliver results for the country, I think the American people will reward you in 2018 and potentially 2020. If you don't deliver results for the country, then they're not going to reward you. And so I think that's the deal about, you know, get your act together, lead, and achieve the results that are important to America. Whether that be on health care, or whether that be on the economy, or whether that be on a host of a lot of other issues, but show us the results, and I think the American people will judge to see if Republicans deserve to keep on leading.
If you've just joined us, Bob Vanderplaats is my guest, president and CEO of The Family Leader. This week, President Trump repeated his contention that women who have accused him of sexual misconduct fabricated their allegations. Should the president be investigated for sexual misconduct, as now over 100 members of Congress are calling for?
Well, I think what it is that with the president, a lot of these ladies came forth already in the election. And for whatever reason, the American people said, we're going to give the presidency to Donald Trump. That doesn't mean that their issue went away because he became president. I think if these ladies need to be heard on this, and they probably should be heard, and then let's let the facts play out. I don't think it should be just easily dismissed because somebody says, no, that didn't happen or that didn't occur.
So you say it should be investigated by Congress.
Yeah, I think if it's credible, we should take a look at it. And the American people have a right to know that. I think Nikki Haley basically said the same thing last week, Sunday.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe, Bob, the change that has gone on in the country even since the election of Donald Trump over a year ago, the so-called Me Too movement? How do you see that? Is that a purely good thing for our society? Do you see it that way?
Well, I think it is. I used to be a high school principal, and obviously I have great concern for men of power or men of any position in life who would happen to prey on women. or anybody with a stature who would happen to prey on anybody that's that they would view as lesser than them or that they get to control. That's always a concern. And so, therefore, I think when the allegations are credible, I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing what happened to the Weinsteins of Hollywood, that this stuff is getting exposed, to say, clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, I think that's part of revival. That's part of, you know, saying, you know, that's wrong. And that's basically a shift in turning our hearts back to God.
Mm-hmm. Is this Me Too movement, do you see it also occurring in Christian conservative circles?
You know, I don't know of any Christian leader yet that has been part of that Me Too moment. I'm not saying it hasn't happened.
Well, I guess I'm talking about the broader conversation of women and men
without question. I think pastors in the pulpit are talking about it. And they may not be saying the Me Too moment, but I think they're pointing out, take a look at where our culture is at. Take a look about sex without parameters. Take a look about, we just think that, you know, anything can go in a culture, and look at what happens, the wreckage that happens to young girls and to women. And quite frankly, there's men that their lives are being destroyed with that same piece of it. So then calling out a higher standard of saying it's about time this country turns its heart back to God, his principle and his precepts. They're for our good. They're not for our harm. And so therefore saying, you know, let's recognize what marriage is and that God says sex is a great thing inside the bounds of marriage.
Bob Vanderplaats is with us this half hour, president and CEO of The Family Leader, an Iowa-based organization that focuses on inspiring Christ-like leadership in the church, home, and government. Let's talk about the case that I'm sure you've, in fact, I know you've been had it on your website, the so-called Masterpiece Cake Shop case before the Supreme Court. It was just heard a few days ago. It involves faith. Jack Phillips, the owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop in Colorado, refuses to make wedding cakes for gay couples. He contends his First Amendment right of free speech and religion exempts him from Colorado's anti-discrimination law. You believe he should be able to refuse to make that cake?
Oh, I really do.
Explain that. Hey, explain that.
Well, I think what it is that it's a thing of, are we going to force people to celebrate what goes against our beliefs? And so, therefore, with Jack, he wasn't denying a person who says they're gay to come in to say, to buy a cupcake or to buy a cake or to buy a whatever and say, you know, they want to have that for whatever. It was when he was asked to do that for a marriage that he basically believes is against the heart of God, mm-hmm. against his religious teachings. And so that's when he said, I don't want to use my artistic skills to basically lend in the celebration of something that I disagree with. And so therefore, I think this goes down to the foundation of our country. Do we have freedom of worship, which means you get to be inside those four walls, but do not take your faith outside those four walls? And I just think that's anti-American. So I think the whole, this religious liberty case, I hope it goes in the favor of anchoring America on the First Amendment, which is religious liberty.
Mm-hmm. This was brought up in the Supreme Court arguments, asked by, I think, Justice Ginsburg and perhaps Justice Kagan. You know, who else is then an artist? Where do you draw the line? Because it doesn't seem to be an easy line to draw if you say cake decorators are artists, are people who make wedding invitations or menus or jewelers or hairstylists or makeup artists. Are they all artists who can serve who they choose and choose to put a sign up that says we do not serve any homosexual couples?
I think take a look at Jack's business. Jack refused to do cakes for Halloween. Because he didn't support Halloween. He saw it as a demonic holiday. And so he wouldn't do Halloween cakes. He wouldn't do basically a KKK cake or a white supremacist cake or mm-hmm. or something that would support that. He wouldn't do that piece of it as well. And so I think what it is, I mean, it could even be we had right here in the state of Iowa, the Gertz House. The Gertz House had a private wedding venue that they used, and a lot of weddings were celebrated there in a beautiful facility, but they didn't want to use their facility to to go against their religious beliefs, and they got sued out of business.
So where is the line, though? Because I think that's what justices on the Supreme Court are really wrestling with. If you say there is a line, where is the line? How do you define that? Or can
the question is are we going to force people to compel? So back in the day, Ben, when we were fighting this issue here in the state of Iowa, matter of fact, I was on the front lines of it a lot of times they'd say, how is gay marriage going to impact you? How's it going to impact your marriage, Bob and Darla? And now it's like, but it'll close your business, or it'll force you to celebrate something that you don't want to celebrate. Where does the line get drawn there? And that's where I think the justices are going to come down and say, we do have religious liberty in this country, and just because we have courts that decided same-sex marriage is now quote-unquote legal, that doesn't mean we should force the Dick and Betty Odegaards or the Jack in Colorado to say, you have to celebrate that. Mm-hmm. And so I think we do have religious liberty in this country, and that's something that should be celebrated, not condemned, and it should not be turned into forced compulsion.
A couple of other things I wanted to get to before we've run out of time here, Bob. The House Republican tax bill, I think, still contains a provision that would allow churches to endorse political candidates. And this rolls back a 1950s-era law that bars such activities. This law states that churches should the change would say that in the new code would say that churches should not lose their tax-exempt status based on statements about political candidates made during the course of religious services. It's known as the Johnson Amendment, the original one, prohibiting nonprofits from engaging in certain political activities. What is the family leader's position on this?
Well, we'd love to see the Johnson Amendment repealed. Mm-hmm. Why was the Johnson Amendment put in the first place? Why was it targeted at churches to say we'll restrict churches' free speech, but we won't restrict a business's free speech or somebody else's free speech? We'll just restrict the church's free speech. And so we've often said at the Family Leader, we don't need you to be political. We need you to be biblical. And then we need to apply the scripture to everyday life, and that includes politics. But you don't need to be political. If you're biblical, that's going to work itself out. But we're saying, why restrict the church's free speech?
Well,
and so therefore, we think the Johnson Amendment is something that could and should be repealed. So we'd support that.
Mm-hmm. And yet, there's evidently disagreement among many faith groups. A group of more than 4,000 religious leaders from around the country wrote a letter in August opposing efforts to repeal the Johnson Amendment, and they said, quote, it would harm houses or worship which are not identified or divided by partisan lines. Do you share that worry? Can you understand that worry that some people say, you know, let's keep politics out of our houses of worship?
Well, I would say this. There's 5,200 churches in the state of Iowa alone. If you have a church that wants to be overtly Republican or overtly Democrat or overtly partisan in any way, shape, or form, I think there's a lot of other churches that are going to stick to the scriptures and the full counsel of the gospel, and those churches will be greatly blessed by it. But I don't think what it is saying we have a fear that all the churches, I don't think all the churches are going to become partisan for a second. Matter of fact, I know the church I attend would never become partisan for a second. What they're going to do is they're going to think bigger, they're going to look higher, they're going to look to the full counsel of God, and they're going to preach the full counsel of the gospel. And I think we shouldn't allow our fear to say that's why we would restrict their opportunity for free speech.
Well, yeah.
Because I've got to believe that Martin Luther King Jr., who was Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., I got to believe at one time, he raised the issue from his pulpit that slavery was against the heart of God. And at that time, that was a very political issue. And I think, you know, pastors should be allowed to preach on that and to teach on that, of how God values the sanctity of human life, how God values the sanctity of marriage, how God values whatever it might be. The scriptures speak to every issue. And so I would never want to restrict the church's free speech there. I'd want the churches to use the scripture that we can apply it to our daily lives.
Bob Vanderplaats, and finally, the Family Leader, your organization supports the president's move to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Explain why conservative Christians, your organization, feel so strongly about Jerusalem being the capital of the Jewish state of Israel?
It's not just conservative Christians. It's liberal Democrats.
Well, I'm asking, I'm asking you as a conservative Christian, why the strong connection with Israel and that Jerusalem should be the capital?
Well, we believe Jerusalem is the Holy Land, and we believe it is the capital of Israel. We believe it's been the capital there for thousands of years, and it's also a thing that it probably should have been recognized in 1948, and it probably should have been recognized in 1967 after the Six-Day War. There's been several presidents. I think of Reagan, I think of Clinton, I think of Bush. All of them are saying, we're going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and they never did it. 1995, I think Congress, bipartisan on a vote that wasn't even close, we recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, because Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. And so when you have a president who says, I'm going to recognize it, I think that's a good move. I think it now allows the peace talks to move forward, and having that chip off the table, that's not a discussion. We recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Now let's talk about how do we bring peace to a very hostile region.
Mm-hmm. And finally, I ask you to wrap this up. Perhaps as briefly, and finally, briefly, if I can ask you to do this, as we come up on 1 year of Donald Trump in office, do you have a quick critique you can share with us, what you're satisfied with, what you're disappointed in?
I think there's, like a lot of leaders, I think there's some good and bad. I think the good moves we just talked about, one, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. I think the tax policy of recognizing tax cuts to put more income so families can thrive, I think that's a good thing. I think the appointment of Justice Gorsuch was a really good thing. I think a lot of his cabinet members are very, very good. There's obviously been some downsides as well. Matter of fact, I wish he would tweet to drive his message and his agenda, but not to get off focus. Because when you get off focus, it creates an uncertainty within the country. And so therefore, I'd love to see more Twitter control. And just bring overall respect to the presidency and across the globe.
Mm-hmm. And you think his tweeting is not doing that?
I think I would be more disciplined with the Twitter activity. That'd be my encouragement to him.
Okay. Bob Vanderplaats, President and CEO of The Family Leader. Always good to talk with you, Bob. Thank you very much for your views.
Oh, thank you, Ben. God bless.
My conversation from yesterday with Bob Vanderplaats, CEO of the Iowa-based organization, The Family Leader. Coming up in just a moment after a short break, political scientist Kedron Bardwell of Simpson College joins me with his take on where Christian conservatives fit in today's political landscape. Also, we'll talk about the Johnson Amendment. That's the provision in the U.S. tax code that prohibits all nonprofit organizations from endorsing or opposing political candidates. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, focusing on changing politics in our country through the lens of Christian conservatives. In the first half hour, if you were with us, a conversation I had with Bob Vanderplaats, CEO of The Family Leader. It's an Iowa-based organization describing its mission as inspiring Christ-like leadership in the church, home, and government. Vanderplaats, you longtime Iowa residents will know, he's run for governor a couple of times. This half hour, we want to talk with political scientist Kedron Bardwell, professor of political science at Simpson College. He joins us from Indianola now. Hi, Kedron. Okay, we're having a little bit of a connection problem there. Kedron, are you there? Not there. Let me tell you a little bit about tomorrow's program. Tomorrow, Friday, usually reserved for News Buzz edition of River to River. We're going to be
The next couple of Fridays, we're going to be looking back at some of the biggest news stories of 2017. Tomorrow, we'll have conversations, excerpts from conversations that have to do with those big stories of this year, this soon to be over. Let's see if Kedron is there. Kedron Bardwell.
Yep, I'm here. Sorry, the line got dropped.
Okay, sorry. If it was our problem, I'm sorry about that. But Kedron, good to have
you
with us right now. You were listening to, I think, the interview last half hour with Bob Vanderplaats. Let me start off this conversation also by telling our listeners to please join us. We got a little bit out of joint there. I want to make sure our listeners feel free to call 1-866-780-9100 or email us, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Kedron, you listened to the Bob Vanderplaats conversation last half hour. Let me just ask what in particular may have stood out for you in that conversation.
Well, I think it's interesting to listen to Vanderplaats speak. I think he's his position on the Alabama question, I think, could have been a little bit more clear. I understand we're not all living in Alabama, but everybody has to make judgments, as he said. Public opinion and the American public have to make a judgment.
You mean his refusal to say how he would have voted?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. But I appreciated a lot of what he said, and I can certainly sympathize with many of the views that come out of that evangelical movement. I was raised in the evangelical movement. My dad was a pastor, a church planter in the evangelical movement, so I'm pretty familiar with. The issues that they're concerned about. So,
What about the point that Bob Vanderplaats would support an investigation into any credible allegations of sexual misconduct of our elected leaders, including of President Trump?
No, I think that was a little bit surprising. At the same time, I think we're really in a cultural moment here, which is. We realized that probably more of this was going on than a lot of people had thought, particularly a number of men had thought, and maybe institutions have not been dealing well with these issues related to sexual harassment and sexual assault. So I think it's a moment where every institution, whether that be the church or politics or business, I think has to have a reckoning about the types of things that it's been tolerating.
Mm-hmm. President Trump certainly not steering clear of it or doing anything to keep his name disconnected as much as possible from the sexual misconduct allegations. I think some 20 women now with allegations against the president. He repeated the contention this week that the women who have accused him of sexual misconduct fabricated the allegations. And then he described Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, one of his leading critics, who has called for an investigation, as a lightweight who would do anything for campaign contributions. So, at the same time, on earlier this week, he had three of Donald Trump's accusers, three women, say in a news conference that their accusations warranted new consideration, given this, well, I guess you called it a cultural moment. Do you see the possibility of the sexual misconduct allegations catching up with the president?
Well, I think they're already starting to, and the issue, as they've been handling it with their communications staff, has basically been to smack down the allegations, say they're completely false, and then also, you know, lay out this argument that they have evidence that would actually contradict many of the statements that were made by these women, yet they haven't produced that evidence. And so I think that's one problem for the administration. The other, as you said, is that Trump keeps popping off on Twitter about this. And starting feuds related to this issue of who believes him and who doesn't regarding the sexual harassment allegations. So he's keeping it in the news as much as anybody, and as much as this cultural moment is.
Mm-hmm. And I think the White House also saying, hey, these allegations were known prior to the election. The election happened. The people spoke. But Bob Vanderplaats, other people making the point as well, that doesn't erase them, right?
Correct. Yeah, I think, and the president's in an interesting situation because I would think, based on prior precedent, that if something more drastic were to be done in terms of sanctioning for these things, it would probably occur through the impeachment, a political process of impeachment, not through a normal legal process. There's been a number of court cases trying to essentially figure out, you know, what can the president even be subject to in terms of legal cases while in office.
Mm-hmm. Kedron, as a political scientist, how are you? It's a fascinating time we're living in. How would you describe the shift that's going on in this country in terms of attitudes, the so-called Me Too movement?
Boy, yeah, you know, I think it's something that, number one, it's a cultural moment that I think affects all generations of people, because everybody's seeing these stories. These are coming to light. The institutions, you know, more so than maybe they would have in the past, are actually taking action. So I think it's a movement that affects everyone. At the same time, I teach in a college setting, and so I've been observing kind of differences in the way that people see issues of gender very differently than maybe older Americans do. I've been seeing those attitudes, which want more enforcement of these types of laws and regulations in terms of sexual harassment, sexual assault. And so I think there's also a movement pushing this in terms of long term. That is, this will have staying power. This isn't something that's going to be a moment and then goes away. The public opinion trends are actually pushing in the direction of being more conscientious of these issues, mm-hmm. as a nation.
So you don't see it slipping back, that we take whatever step this is in attitudes, the shift in the cultural.
Yes, I hope not, but I'm not expecting that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit to get your views on what happened in Alabama this week. Of course, Judge Roy Moore, he is a Christian conservative, supported by a lot of Alabama's Christian conservatives. What does it say to you that nearly half of Alabama's voters chose Roy Moore despite credible allegations of sexual misconduct from multiple women, and one with a teenage girls, one 14, claimed a credible claim of sexual assault while he was in his 30s?
It speaks to that. I think people are seeing just about any fact, any issue, any event through a lens of political partisan tribalism. We need to move, I think, away from that as a country, that being the lens that we see every issue through. We need to be able to agree to common facts and not just say, well, if that fact is inconvenient to my narrative, I'm going to discard it. But I think, a number of people still did vote for Roy Moore, despite the fact that I think most independent observers said, look, these allegations and the evidence that was presented on behalf of him was extremely credible. At the same time, Alabama is a very unique state. If you look at the partisanship in the last number of elections, it's gone just overwhelmingly to the Republican side. Remember that when Jeff Sessions ran for Congress, he essentially ran unopposed as a Republican. Recall that there hadn't been a senator elected who was a Democrat in Alabama since 1992. And that person, Richard Shelby, is actually now a Republican who switched parties.
Yes.
And is the person who made a statement a few days ago, which I think was actually a very important one, and said he wasn't going to vote for Roy Moore and he was going to write in the name of another good Republican. So, Alabama's a very unique state.
And that nearly 2% of write-in votes would have handed, had they been in Roy Moore's corner, they would have perhaps handed him the victory.
That's something to watch, is that was a relatively large write-in number, and also something that's been pointed out to me as I've looked at some of the statistics coming out of the election is that Democratic turnout and the turnout of moderate Republicans seem to be up, and the turnout of the Republican base that would normally be coming out for someone like Roy Moore was depressed, was down, and I think that's even true of the evangelical groups, that a number of them either wrote in someone else or sat this one out.
Kedrin Bardwell, professor of political science at Simpson College, joining us this half hour. Let's talk about the Johnson Amendment. I talked with Bob Vanderplaats about this. The House, I don't know if it's still in there. I mean, we don't know, really, because we don't know the details of how the House and the Senate have come to agreement. They have an agreement in theory. They're hammering it out as we speak, perhaps. Containing, though, a provision in the House Republican tax bill that would allow churches to endorse political candidates. And this rolls back a 1950s-era law that bars such activities, endorsing or opposing candidates, the Johnson Amendment. Give us a little background on the Johnson Amendment.
Sure. The story around the Johnson Amendment, this is basically 1954. There was a law that was reinstating and rewriting certain provisions of the IRS code. And the story behind it is that Johnson was a senator, and he was running for re-election, and essentially there was someone who ran an educational or nonprofit organization who took out some materials to try to defeat him or primary him. And so Johnson, in the course of the tax bill being pushed through, put an amendment in there that said that 501c3 groups, which are basically nonprofit organizations, many of them, should not be able to directly support or oppose a candidate for office. So that's the origin of it. The debate since then has gotten pushed along a number of different lines, and I would want to push back on something that Bob said. The Johnson Amendment wasn't specifically targeted at churches. It was, again, it was applied to all 501c3 organizations, which includes charities,
right.
Educational and, organizations like Simpson College, like colleges and churches.
Right, and also just to make sure we know, listening to Bob Vanderplaats, you might think that we were going to stop pastors, ministers from speaking out politically. That's not it. It is simply that they would not have a tax-exempt status as a church, right?
Right, right. And that's where, again, I want to reinforce that he brought up Martin Luther King, and would King been able to talk, you know, about slavery, about civil rights? Well, of course you would, because the Johnson Amendment doesn't bar that. It's not a problem for pastors to talk about any issues. And in fact, there's a long number of things that pastors and churches can do positively to get involved in politics. It just falls short of the idea of an actual endorsement. You know, voting for or against, running ads that say vote for or against, or channeling money through their churches to undermine campaign finance laws. So there's lots of things churches can do.
Okay, so suppose this makes it into the bill by the House and the Senate that would allow churches to endorse political candidates. How do you see that changing, I guess, a tighter mingling between the faith communities and politics, or a more open intermingling? Perhaps it's already been there to that degree.
No, I think it has been to some extent, because as I said, you can talk about issues. You can hold nonpartisan voter registration drives. A church can even put out voter guides as long as they're relatively nonpartisan. They can have issue forums. They can even lobby to a certain percentage of their revenues. They can get involved in court battles, ballot initiatives, all types of stuff. And clergy can individually, this is the one thing I think it's left out in this conversation, clergy can individually endorse candidates, and they do that, although a lot of them see the wisdom of not doing it, and that's the thing that I would emphasize as well. Is that even among evangelicals, there's quite a few pastors who would say, don't do this, because it's an issue that might divide your church and would create some problems in terms of unity.
Mm-hmm. Do you see it as sort of equally divided in among Christian conservatives, among all Christians, or do you see this as one side of the, you know, more wanting the repeal of the Johnson Amendment?
Well, I actually have data on that. I've got data that other people have gathered, and I gathered my own in 2012 when I did a survey of clergy in Iowa. The national data that I'm familiar with comes from Lifeway Research, which is run by Ed Stetzer, a Baptist pollster, and he has data essentially saying that 9 out of 10 Protestant pastors say that pastors should not endorse from the pulpit because it's not wise pastorally. Could be divisive, it could distract from the gospel message. But we actually have Iowa data on this too. In my 2012 survey, I'd asked evangelicals, Catholics, and mainline Protestant pastors what their views on this were. Should churches, should pastors evade or buck the IRS regulations and simply endorse candidates? And only 19% of evangelicals said that we should do that. So that's 81% of evangelicals said that pastors shouldn't be endorsing. And only 5% of mainline and Catholic clergy supported the idea of churches and pastors endorsing. So it's not even within the church or even within the evangelical church, not necessarily something that pastors think that people should be doing because it can be divisive.
Mm-hmm. So given that information and your data on this specific issue, why then would House Republicans be pushing this if it's 9 out of 10 pastors are against it, or places of worship?
Well, there are certain more conservative evangelicals who feel like this is a restriction. This is a free speech issue. They feel like their voices as individuals might be silenced. Now, remember, again, they can endorse as individuals. There's nothing stopping someone from doing that. So, I think their perspective is we should be able to say what we want from the pulpit, and the IRS shouldn't be sicked on us. Federal government shouldn't try to take away our tax exempt status. The one thing to really keep in mind about all of this, we've been arguing kind of around the main issue here. The main issue with the Johnson Amendment and what it protects is it protects someone from basically driving a Mack truck through the campaign finance regulations. And what I mean by that is dark money in politics is a problem. A lot of it, almost $1 billion of it, that's billion with a B, has been spent since the Citizens United decision in 2010 to try to influence politics. If you get rid of the Johnson Amendment, there's a chance that individual donors will use churches essentially as pass-throughs. That is, if they want to influence election, they not only can give to an organization that might speak on their behalf and try to advocate for a candidate or try to oppose a candidate, but you could get a tax deduction for it, right? Remember that churches, you actually can get a tax deduction for giving to a church or a charity. So, again, this would just break open one of the main constraints in our campaign finance law that prevents this type of millionaire money and dark money from coming into politics without regulation.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this will make it through? I mean, it's a hard prediction to make. Will it make it through to the final tax overhaul?
I think there is a decent amount of pressure behind it just because the number of conservative Republicans and evangelical leaders have been behind it, even though some are not as enthusiastic. The president has been pushing it. It didn't make it into the Senate bill, and so the chances are that maybe some of the Senate conferees are not as excited about this as the folks in the House are. So we'll see. This is interesting because it's also a solution in search of a problem. There's only been one church that has ever lost its tax-exempt status by getting involved advocating in an election, and that was way back in the Bill Clinton years. So it's not even a fully enforced measure by the IRS at this point.
Mm-hmm. Kedrin, we have about 5 minutes left. Kedrin Bardwell, if you've just joined us, political science professor at Simpson College in Indianola. I wanted to ask you about, I saw a piece in the New York Times, I'm not sure if you saw it, but the author, Peter Wehner, noted that several of his pastor friends no longer use the label evangelical to describe themselves,
yep,
even though they meet every element of this historical definition. And one of the comments from one of the pastors who's dropped this as a moniker, because the term is now so stained as to ruin my ability to be what evangelicalism was supposed to be. Another said evangelical is no longer a word we can use, because it's not a religious identification so much as a political one. Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I would agree with that. And it's also deja vu because the term fundamentalist actually started out with a positive connotation among those who were, you know, Bible believing, who had certain orthodox beliefs about Scripture, about God, about Jesus Christ. But over the years, the term fundamentalism and its use in the media took on a negative connotation, and so people have moved away from that term. I think we're probably seeing the same thing with the word evangelical. That is, people might say this individually represents where I am in terms of my beliefs about God, my beliefs about Christ, my beliefs about the gospel and conversion and evangelism. But when people in the world see this, when someone who's not religiously affiliated sees the world, the word evangelical, all they think about is politics. They say, well, okay, you're basically a white, older Republican. So I think there are many in the evangelical movement, particularly those 40 and under, who are saying this term just isn't as useful as it used to be. So it'll be interesting to see if they can come up with some other way of referring to themselves that doesn't immediately have a political connotation rather than a theological connotation.
Mm-hmm. There are plenty of listeners who are not evangelical Christians listening to you now. But remind us, what is the historical definition of an evangelical?
Yeah, historically, the definition generally refers to a group that would believe that the Scriptures are the revelation of God. They take a view of those Scriptures that is not necessarily always literal, but at least that it is God's word and not merely words written by men inspired by God. They believe in the idea of evangelism, the idea of spreading the gospel. They believe Jesus Christ is the only way to salvation or way to heaven. So there are certain fundamental beliefs like that mark evangelicals as having a slightly different emphasis in terms of theology as mainline Protestants would.
Mm-hmm. In the minute or so we have, we're on the eve of 2018. What are your thoughts about the major themes for the upcoming midterm election campaign?
Well, you know, there's a lot of time left. That's the one thing I would say, and I think Bob Vanderplaats is right. It's hard to take one election result and say that this predicts what's going to happen almost a year from now. That said, if you look at the fundamentals of the economy tend to be fairly good, which would lean toward the party in power. But I think what should concern Republicans right now is not just the results of these individual races, but the fact that the Republican approval rating, that people's generic ballot when you ask them whether they'll vote for a Republican or a Democrat in 2018, and the president's approval ratings are all each very low, especially given that good economy. So essentially what that tells you is that Republicans are underperforming. They're not where they should be given the state of things in terms of the macroeconomic situation in the United States.
So we don't have a long time to talk about it, but I suppose this tax reform being rushed through by the Republicans may give a boost if it goes into effect on January 1st, even though the polls indicate it's quite unpopular.
Well, I think it'll give a boost to the base, and you energize your base at a midterm because the midterm elections have lower turnout. But at the same time, as you note, it's got 25-30% approval. So that really is what you're doing, is only energizing the base and not trying to win over people that otherwise you need, like independents and moderates.
Kedron Bardwell, always great to have you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Professor of Political Science at Simpson College in Indianola, Kedron Bardwell. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton with help from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Join us tomorrow as we listen to excerpts from conversations from some of the biggest news stories of 2017. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.